Okay, I think we'll just go ahead and start, and if we get support here, but this is lecture number 3 in your book, so you can kind of follow the lectures in the book. And if we get further support, that'll be good, but otherwise we'll just work with the paper. The subject here is the theory of microfoundations and what I call methodological localism, which is contrasted to some ideas that you've probably heard about before. One is methodological individualism, a theory of the social sciences, which says that all social statements must be reduced to statements about individuals. That's methodological individualism. Methodological holism is at the other extreme, and it asserts that there are social facts which are essentially independent of individuals. So you've got the extreme view, individualism, you have the other extreme, holism, and then what I advocate is a theory of methodological localism, which I'll explain today. That in a sense, it's one of the ideas that I'm the most excited about in the philosophy of social science. So the first major topic then for the day is rational choice theory. And what I would like to do is to give just a little bit of explanation of what rational choice theory is, but then explore in a little bit of detail how rational choice theory works as a foundation or a groundwork for social explanation. And what I would like to assert is that rational choice theory offers a powerful basis for social explanation. Now, what do I mean by that? Why do I assert that? I assert it not really because of the technical particulars of microeconomic theory or of game theory. In other words, game theory and microeconomics and maybe even some versions of Marxism, these are all very specific theories of individual rationality. When I say that rational choice theory is a powerful basis for social explanation, what I mean to assert is that social explanations grounded in a theory of human agency, human purposiveness, human deliberation, that those theories are very powerful. That in other words, in the social sciences, it is always intelligent to begin with an analysis of the situation of the intelligent agents, the persons, the individuals who make up a particular social process. And rational choice theory is a slight formalization of that view. Because it regards the individual as having a set of purposes, having an ability to collect beliefs, collect knowledge about the environment, to make calculations and make predictions about future states of the environment, and then to choose an action which best serves the interests and preferences and desires which the individual has. So in other words, it's as if we're looking at a group of people and then we're trying to explain the behavior of the group of people by asking, what are each of these people trying to accomplish? What is it that they wish to accomplish? What do they believe about the options available to them? And then we make a prediction. They will choose an option which is intelligently related to achieving what their goals are. So what I'm asserting then is that in many institutional contexts, self-interested prudence, that, again, that's a kind of narrowing definition of human agency. Self-interested prudence is acting out of regard for one's own interests, however we define those interests. And I'm asserting in many institutional contexts, self-interested prudence dominates other factors. And therefore, we can make use of the tools of formal rational choice theory, including game theory, neo-economic theory, game theory, maybe Marxism. We can use these theories as empirically credible theories of individual behavior. And I will be referring, another section here is the topic of the new institutionalism, and we'll be referring to that later. Now you might ask, what is rational choice theory, or what is the theory of agency in opposition to? And you could quickly come up with a couple of examples of other theories of human behavior. So you might say people act impulsively. They don't foresee consequences. They just act according to emotion. That would be a possible theory. Another theory would be people act as rule followers. So they absorb the rules around them, and then they just kind of mindlessly follow the rules. That would be a second possible theory. The theory of rational choice, or the theory of deliberative human agency, that theory says individuals make choices. They consider alternatives, they consider what their goals and purposes are, they act deliberatively. And maybe that's a word that I should write down. Because what I'm really referring to, when I talk about rational choice theory, I'm really talking about a theory of human action which emphasizes deliberation and choice. Agency, in referring to an individual, refers to the individual's ability to choose and to determine what his or her actions will be. And so within the context of rational choice theory, we work on the assumption that the individual is deliberative. The individual gathers information about the world, whether you are a political official or you are a peasant farmer in Hebei. I had the wonderful opportunity to see some farms in Hebei this weekend, so now I know a little bit of what I'm talking about when I refer to the peasant, the rational peasant. Whether you're an official or a farmer, you consider what is the environment in which I make actions, you gather knowledge, and you formulate your own objectives of what you're trying to accomplish. You, thirdly, have a coherent representation of goals, preferences, and desires. In other words, to be deliberative is not simply to act helter-skelter. It is to determine what is it I'm trying to accomplish, what are the goals that I have, how do they relate together, and then what actions can I choose so as to bring about the best satisfaction of those goals. And so, fourthly, the individual makes rational decisions, by which I mean calculating decisions or deliberative decisions between the available alternatives. An example that I would offer to you is a peasant farmer. So the peasant farmer grows, let's say, rice or wheat, and the person from the university comes and says, here's a new seed variety that you can use, and on average it will have much higher yields than that old variety, the traditional variety. So the farmer considers that possibility. He talks to other farmers who've used the new variety. He validates, yes, indeed, the new variety does have a higher yield, but it is more subject to failure if there's not enough water or if there's a little too much water. The high yield variety tends to die completely, so there's no crop at all, whereas the traditional variety is hardier. And so the farmer does a little mental calculation where he's got time and output, and he's got something like this for crop yields with the traditional variety, and he's got something like this with, this is the modern variety, the high yield variety, where the average for the one and the average for the other is clearly different. So if you're a businessman, a business person, you would say, let's go for this one, because over time, my gains will be greater. I'll have a higher average yield. And so this proposition is brought to the peasant farmer. The peasant farmer now collects the information. He says to the agent from the university, you're right, the average for the high yield variety is higher. However, these spikes mean disaster for my family. My family will not survive the winter if the crop is completely wiped out. And so the farmer makes a risk averse choice and chooses the traditional variety over the high yield variety. I would offer that as a great example of deliberative rationality. Now, some people have said, this graph shows that peasants are not rational. The peasants should go for this variety rather than this variety. But I think that my explanation actually illustrates the rationality of choosing the traditional variety, because it makes very unlikely the possibility that the whole family will starve or be forced into destitution as a result of these occasional crop failures. Well, that would be an example, then, of rational deliberation, gathering information, deciding what is your highest priority goal, and how can I achieve that highest priority goal. So individuals choose the option that best serves their ranking of outcomes, given their beliefs about the world. Now, there are some qualifications within rational choice here. And one other point I should make that is not in the slide here. That description that I gave of deliberative calculating agency, that is really the foundation of rational choice theory. But then the particular areas of economics and game theory and applied political science, a wide range of formal disciplines in the social sciences are then formal models of these assumptions. Assumptions about maximization, assumptions about assessment of risk, assessment of probabilities, decision-making under risk and uncertainty is an area of formal rational choice modeling. And the point is that each of those is a formal mathematization of the basic assumptions of deliberative agency. And you, of course, once you have a formal model, you could then work forward an analysis of something like this, you know, the situation of the peasant farmer, and you can work forward and then offer a prediction about how the farmer will behave. The reason, though, I'm kind of dwelling on this point for a minute is that there is a separation between the general theory of deliberative agency and then the more specific theories of game theory, neoclassical economics, and decision theory. These are each efforts to offer mathematical specifications of these robust general premises about individual decision making. Now, some qualifications, I'm moving on to the next slide. Economists, generally, when they think of rationality, they think of rational egoism. They think of the idea that individuals decision-making is couched in terms of a complete preference ranking, which has to do with one's own rational self-interest. And so rational egoism is a part of economic reasoning, but what I would assert is that it's not inherently a part of the notion of deliberative agency. In other words, this is a broader theory than the particular embodiments of rational choice theory within economics. And as a matter of fact, it is, you know, as we think about human action, human decision making, it's pretty clear that individuals make decisions, rational and calculating decisions, which often take into account other people. So that egoism is really, I would say, just a bad empirical theory. It has value because there are some areas of decision making where other people's interests really don't come in. If you're buying a cup of coffee, for example, your most likely decision making is best quality, lowest price, greatest convenience. In other words, maximizing your own ability to get the cup of coffee most conveniently at the lowest price. Well, that would be an exercise of rational egoism. You're just asking, you know, what do I want out of this? I want a cup of coffee, and I want to pay not very much for it. But in other instances, for example, will I join a union? Or will I join a boycott or a strike? Under those circumstances, the relationship between rational self-interest and the interests which I have in other people, those other person-oriented interests become more important. And in fact, we can refer to things like solidarity, the idea that I don't want to let my group down, that that's a part of my decision-making process. The idea of affection and loyalty. I care for my family, therefore I don't just, you know, if the lifeboat is full, I don't just shove them out of the lifeboat. I actually sacrifice something for them. Those would be examples of altruistic behavior, which is not irrational. That's the point that I'm getting at. And I refer here on this slide to an essay by Amartya Sen, whose name you've now heard several times, who wrote a very important essay called Rational Fools. Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He wrote a book, not a book, but an article, Rational Fools. It's in the bibliography on the CD-ROM, Rational Fools, which is a critique of the idea of self-interested rational egoism. And he argues that social life is really impossible if individuals really acted as wholly rationally self-interested decision makers. And so instead, I personally put forward, but a number of philosophers and social theorists have put forward, a broader conception of rationality, a conception which is broader than simply maximization of utilities, but rather a conception which takes into account the fact that as I make decisions, I take into account what are the consequences for me, that is a maximizing kind of comparison, what are the moral requirements which I recognize in this situation, what are the commitments which I recognize to other people. In other words, our decision-making, though rational, is complex. So we do pay attention to the commitments and kind of loyal relationships which we have with other people. And so what we can say then is that people act prudently with regard to their goals, inflected by their norms and commitments. Now, I believe that this is a pretty robust theory of deliberative agency, and that's why I'm pretty confident in putting it forward as a foundation or a grounding for social explanation. If you had the really narrow conception of rational choice, the economist's conception, then I would not be so confident, because there are large pieces of human behavior that seem not to fit into rational, self-interested prudence. But once you bring in the idea that it is rational to take account of norms, to take account of the affinities which I have with other people, the loyalties I have, the sense of fairness which I have, all of that, according to me, is a part of rational calculation. Under those circumstances, we have a pretty rich conception of individual agency. Now I'm turning to a really important issue. It's the literature of collective action. And the person who kind of got this topic started is the man I refer to on the slide, Manser Olson, O-L-S-O-N. But what Olson demonstrated in the 1960s is that there is a separation or a contradiction between rational self-interest and rational group interest. You are a group. You are the group of students who are taking this course, or you're a group of students at Peking Summer School. And the point that Olson made is that groups often have shared interests, things which, as a group, it would be a good thing for them to bring about. But he also points out each individual in a group has a distinct set of individual and personal interests. And his point is that those two things in a group often separate because of the possibility of free riding. The point is basically, I think the Peking Summer School is not a particularly good example, but environmental topics are a good example. We are all people who enjoy the lake, right over here, right? We enjoy the lake. We enjoy the fact that it's very beautiful. And there are a lot of flowers around the lake. Now I'm having to make up the story because I haven't seen a lot of flowers, actually. But let's suppose there are a lot of flowers around the lake. And part of the pleasure that we all as a group take in viewing the lake is the fact of the flowers and the clean water. Each of us individually has a private interest in having some flowers at home in our dorm room. And so each of us, now every time we walk past the lake, we have a choice to make. Will I collect some flowers, or will I leave the flowers for everyone to enjoy? And the reasoning could be, if I take one flower, the view is unharmed. So my picking one flower does not affect my ability to enjoy the entire view. And on the other hand, the view will disappear if everyone takes one flower, but my choosing to take one flower does not determine that you will choose to take one flower. And further, my choosing not to take one flower does not cause you to not take one flower. In other words, everyone in this group has an independent set of choices to make, and so Olson's prediction is that each individual has a rational incentive to be a free rider. With the result that collective purposes will tend to be quickly undermined by individual behavior. So the collective action problem is basically that collective purposes are very difficult to achieve because every individual has a rational incentive to become a free rider. Now, I'd like for you to note this for a second, because when we talk, I'd like to come back to this issue. I think this is a very important issue. There are examples that we could give from, there are a million examples that we could give about environment, about labor solidarity, about the ability of any group to defend its interests. And Olson demonstrates that if we make the assumption of economic rationality, of rational prudence on the part of the members of the group, if there's a separation between the public good of the group and the private good of the individuals, then the prediction is individuals will pursue their private good and the public good will disappear. Now, there are ways of getting around this. If, for example, it is possible to make the public good into something like a regulated good or a semi-private good. If, for example, a small group of people had an interest in fishing in the lake, and if they were able to exclude other people from fishing from the lake, it would then be in their interest to manage the fish stock at a sustainable level. So that would be an example of a solution to a collective action problem. But notice what it requires is excluding other people from access. In other words, it turns a public good into something else. And the reason why I emphasize collective action problems or public goods problems is it's a really strong example of the way in which rational choice theory or deliberative agency can explain a range of social outcomes that are all over the place. They're in the Chinese Revolution, they're in collective agriculture, they're in environmental problems, they're in labor action. Every place that you think of an instance where a group has an interest and individuals have their own private interests, it is possible for these collective action problems to emerge. And by understanding the logic of collective action, we will then have a basis for explaining those social outcomes. Now, the qualifications that I would refer to here are, in a sense, the Menker-Olson theory, the theory of collective action, is an abstract theory, and it explains many instances of failed collective action. But here's the deal. There are also many instances of successful collective action. There are many instances where groups actually do manage to handle the problem of free riding. They do manage to hold together. They do manage to stay committed to or striving towards the collective interest. And so the question now for us is, you know, kind of working high-level social scientists, how does that happen? What further assumptions do we have to make about individual behavior and the institutional setup of a group in the context of which collective action is actually possible? And we've got some great examples from political science and related disciplines. For example, I refer here to Eleanor Ostrom, who is a woman who has studied environmental regimes in different parts of the world. And environmental means grasslands, forests, fisheries, waterlands, water resources, and so forth. If we were just taking the collective action problem seriously, then you would have what is referred to as the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons, is that a term that you ever heard? I don't know if in Chinese there's a similar concept, but the tragedy of the commons is the idea, it's like the lake here. If everyone enjoys the lake by taking a couple of fish and taking a couple of flowers from the lake, there will be overuse of the lake because each person is privately consuming and the public good is going down every year. It's getting worse and worse until eventually there are no fish and no flowers around the lake. That would be referred to as the tragedy of the commons. In England, there was the commons. I don't know if this is familiar to you from English economic history, but peasant villages would have private land that was the farmland, and then a commons where the families could take their ox to graze. And the tragedy of the commons is that the commons gets badly overused by people buying more and more ox, more and more sheep, eating more and more grass, until now the common land is completely exhausted. That's referred to as the tragedy of the commons. What Eleanor Ostrom finds, this is kind of a thrilling stuff, this is pretty exciting. What she finds is that there are examples all over the world, in Africa, in Asia, in the United States, in Spain, examples of communities which have solved the problem of the commons. They've come up with local arrangements which permit them to make rational use of what are referred to as common properties, like fish stocks, grazing land, access to clean water, and so forth. And so this is a way in which we can now dive into the question of how do collective action problems get resolved. How does water, access to water, for example, for agriculture and for other human purposes, how do communities handle the fact that water can be overused and contaminated if each individual is just making his own choices? What kind of social arrangements can be designed? Eleanor Ostrom does quite a bit of analysis there. Michael Taylor is a political scientist who also addresses the question of communities acting as, you know, kind of organized groups. And he makes the point that traditional peasant communities have many ways of kind of forcing or enforcing a form of behavior which is consistent with the collective good and which is punishing of free riding. An example that we may talk about a little later, but probably won't because the time will be short, is the example, if you live in a Vietnamese village and you are a Vietnamese villager, and you have a little farm and whatnot, and there's a tiger. And the tiger tends to come to the village and eat the sheep periodically and threaten the children. Well, the village has a collective interest in getting rid of the tiger. And there is a well-established way of getting rid of the tiger. Bring 20 men together and go off on a tiger hunt, capture the tiger and kill the tiger. Okay, so the public good is organize a tiger hunt and kill the tiger. But here's the problem. Tiger hunts are very, very dangerous. Tigers are dangerous animals. And so every individual peasant has an interest in evading this responsibility. So I know I'm not interested in the tiger hunt today. Or maybe more likely, I'm thrilled to be a part of your tiger hunt, but today my child is very sick. Or today I have to go into the market town. Or, in other words, offer excuses. And also hope that other people will control the tiger, because the tiger is a real threat to the village. Well, the point that Michael Taylor makes is that villages and village people understand these impulses very well and have informal mechanisms. So if you refuse to come on the tiger hunt, then you will be laughed at, and the villagers will come together in the evening and they will be smoking their pipes and they will be laughing at the people who didn't come. If the gentry of the village have been bad gentry, bad landlords, they will be the subject of nasty humor and sarcasm and rude stories and jokes. In other words, Michael Taylor refers to the informal sanctions which a community can organize in order to enforce something like collective behavior. The final point I'll mention on this slide is the idea of conditional altruism, the idea that people, this seems to be a kind of a generalization. When people belong to groups, there is a kind of threshold where people are willing to cooperate with the group to the extent that they are confident that other people will cooperate. In other words, very few of us are complete heroes who say, I will go off and fight the tiger by myself if necessary. But many of us would be inclined to say, if I'm pretty confident that 10 people will show up with spears, then I also will show up with a spear, because 10 people can handle a tiger. If I think it's fewer than 10, I'm not going to go, because it's too dangerous. That would be what we could refer to as conditional altruism. And again, we find good examples sociologically. Okay, we're making a segue. We're moving to the new institutionalism. And again, this is a topic which I find just hugely important in the social sciences. It fits into the micro-foundations view, it fits into the aggregative explanation view, and it fits into the methodological localism view. So what is the new institutionalism? It is a group of people, I think largely in the United States and Great Britain, who are sociologists, political scientists, and area specialists, like China specialists or Southeast Asian specialists. They are people who argue that a critical element of social process is the particular institutional setting in which individuals find themselves. It is, a definition could be that an institution is a system of incentives and constraints. It is a set of rules, both formal and informal, which define the rules of a given activity. And so it might be the land use system. What are the rules of land use? For example, driving through Hebei, is it permissible to grow a little bit of corn right at the edge of the road? Because you sometimes see two rows of corn. And the question arises, whose land is that? What are the rules which determine whether you, as a peasant farmer, can go and plant the two rows of corn on the so-called public land, or if there's a punishment for that? And if there's a punishment for it, then you won't do it, or you will try to evade, or you will... Anybody know what happens to land boundaries in traditional societies? That there is a tendency for the land boundaries to extend by a few inches, a few feet, year after year. And so the mowing pattern or the cultivating pattern, there's always a rational interest, if you've got a little bit of land, to extend the footprint a little bit. Now, of course, your neighbors also have that rational incentive. But extending into the public land, taking a little bit more public land each time you plow, that sounds like a pretty good strategy. So the public officials now have to recognize that incentive and then come up with an institutional setting to discourage it. So the new institutionalism says basically, here's a really great way of getting a social explanation going. Find a phenomenon, then look to see what are the particular social rules, incentives, and constraints which are built in at the local level which constrain or incentivize individual behavior. I refer to a couple of examples here, but one that has an Asian context is labor cooperation in Taiwan farming. And I've referred to this example once before, but it's the change that happened in Taiwan before and after the Japanese occupation of Taiwan. And before the occupation, farming was... I guess you'd call it dry agriculture, but it was had very informal and traditional forms of irrigation, so that every farm needed to have a substantial amount of labor available for the peak times of labor because of the uncertainty of water supply. And under those circumstances, the anthropologist who went to Taiwan would find that family structure was complex. It was called... Actually, I don't remember what it was called, but mother and father, several adult children, and then several of the next generation of children for each family. And so altogether, there might be 20 or 25 people in a, I think, STEM family, but I may have the terminology reversed. Anyway, it's a group of three or four families related by blood occupying a farm and then farming together. after the Japanese occupation of Taiwan and the establishment of a huge water and irrigation project, water became perfectly regular and perfectly predictable. That need for peak labor demand disappeared because there was no risk of there not being enough water. And within a relatively short period of time, that large family structure broke into individual separate, what do you call it? Core families?
From the extended family.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea. So it broke up into those single atomized families. And the question is, why did that happen? The answer, which this man Burton Pasternak puts forward, is an institutional answer. The rules of the game changed and the environmental circumstances changed. The incentives that were available and the disincentives that were available changed dramatically. Once that change occurred, what he refers to as the normal frictions of family life pushed families into separation. Well, it's a great example, I think. The topic of aggregative explanation, some of you have already picked up on this topic in your papers, but it is the idea, well, where do we go from an analysis of deliberative agency to a social explanation? What I just walked through is an example of aggregative explanation. Under the previous irrigation circumstances, families had an incentive. Each family had an individual incentive to hold itself together, to keep the labor power of the family together, to be able to farm effectively. So that was a set of incentives. Aggregate that to the whole of rural Taiwanese society, and you get a particular family structure. So an aggregative explanation is one which takes you from the typical circumstances of decision makers to the aggregate social pattern which follows from that situation of decision making. Collective action columns are exactly an example of aggregative explanation, because we go from the private interests of the individual, and then we calculate what is the aggregate consequence of a large number of people reasoning in this way. The aggregate consequence is failure of collective action. Aggregate means to add together. So to aggregate is to add together. It is to bring together many individual parts and make one whole. And an example would be here would be an example. It's not a really good example, but do you know that termites, when they make their structures, each termite, you know, the termite mounds, you know, that's what I'm talking about, the objects that termites live in Africa, they live in these big termites, yeah. Termite is an insect. Do you know what a termite is? It eats wood, eats the wood. Doesn't matter, it's an insect. It is a social insect, and they're like bees, except they don't fly. Bees, right? Each termite contributes to the making of the mound by exuding a structure that maybe looks something like that. So each termite kind of exudes this stuff and makes sort of a cell of material. But when you take tens of thousands of termites and aggregate this single pattern to a whole nest, what you get is something that's pretty cellular. I'm trying to come up with an example. Maybe this is not a very good example, but it's the idea is you go from the individual pattern of construction for the termite to the aggregate, the whole structure which emerges from these independent activities of many individual termites. The analogy for human beings, if each individual university student has an incentive to study very hard for the qualifying examinations, that's the individual level incentive. The collective outcome, the aggregate outcome, will be a whole population of Chinese students who have really developed their power to memorize and answer examination questions very well, and maybe not have developed other capacities. In other words, the aggregate consequence of individual behavior, that's what I'm referring to, the aggregate consequences of individual behavior. Okay, third big topic, the micro foundations model. This is one of the big, big topics of this course. It is the idea that all macro level social phenomena must be supported by hypotheses about underlying local circumstances of purposive or deliberative choice by agents bringing about the macro outcome. So let me go through that again. It is the thesis that says all macro level, all high level social phenomena, when we make a claim about the high level social pattern or structure or causal connection, we must at the same time be able to provide a micro foundation for that assertion at the level of purposive individuals within specific social circumstances of choice. So if we assert the financial markets in the United States in the 1840s caused the rapid development of the railroad system in the 1860s. If we said that, financial markets in the United States caused rapid extension of rail network in the United States. The micro foundations requirement says we have to be able to say how the first circumstance, the nature of the financial markets, changed the decision-making environment, the opportunities, the incentives, the prohibitions, and so forth, for the various players, the investors, the town officials, the speculators, the possible riders on the rail system, and so forth. We need to be able to say how that collective fact, the financial structure, led to circumstances of decision-making for individuals, which then led back to the other aggregate or high-level social phenomenon. This is a really important point, so I don't want to go by it without making sure that we get it. It is a requirement that we drop from the aggregate level, the macro level, the social level, down to the causal mechanisms, the individual level processes by which the other macro or social outcome occurs. Now, in physics, you might say, well, physics also has a micro foundations requirement. When we say that freezing causes water to expand, freezing causes water to expand, so freezing is a macro circumstance, water expanding into ice is a macro circumstance, and in physics, we also can provide the micro foundations because we can tell the story of how the physics of water molecules work and how they acquire an orientation when they drop to a certain energy level with the crystalline structure of ice then having more volume. We can tell that story, but it isn't necessary to tell the story because the connection between freezing and expansion of ice is an absolutely reliable connection. What I assert about the social sciences is we don't have those absolutely reliable connections. Therefore, it's an important research objective to be able to say what are the local level circumstances through which specific hypothesized causal relationships are thought to obtain. So what is the kind of the level, the unit level? It is the idea of agents within structures and also structures embodied in the states of individuals. So the idea of the micro foundational level is that it's looking at the typical social circumstances of actors, decision makers, and people whose behavior is affected by the social circumstances. We look to those circumstances, and then we try to figure out, as a matter of deliberative agency, how will people behave in those circumstances, and then what are the aggregate consequences of that behavior. What this rules out is the idea of pure structural causation, causation by one higher level social entity causing another higher level social entity. What I'm asserting is we always have to drop down to the causal mechanism at the level of the individual within social circumstances. And it's what I refer to as methodological localism. So what I assert then is that macro explanations require micro foundations. And these are detailed accounts of the pathways by which macro level social patterns come about. In other words, I'm asserting to you, as young social science students, most of you are, that you should always be suspicious when a claim is put forward, the state caused imperialism, or the world trading system caused slavery, or slavery caused industrial revolution in Great Britain. These are macro to macro assertions. I don't say they're incorrect. What I do say is you must have a theory of the pathways from here to the level of individuals in many different circumstances back to industrial revolution or whatever. So in other words, I'm offering a kind of methodological advice. Always look for those underlying, more or less local, individual level pathways and mechanisms. I'm asserting also, as I did in last the lecture on Thursday, social causation proceeds always through the structured circumstances of choice of individual agents. I'm really saying there's no other mechanism. The structured circumstances of choice of individual agents, that is the only way in which social entities acquire causal powers. And institutions have effects on individual behavior through a system of incentives, constraints, indoctrination, et cetera, which in turn produce aggregate social outcomes. Having toured a bunch of Buddhist temples recently, you can ask yourself the question, when a society is exposed in a very penetrating but local way to a particular set of religious ideas, a particular set of ideas about the relationship of the individual to the family, to the community, to the spiritual. In other words, a kind of organized set of ideas about values and individuals and their relationships and so forth. That is a perfectly material story to tell. It sounds spiritual, it sounds religious, but it's not at all. It's a story about the way that individuals come to have a certain set of ideas, values, orientations, motivations. And then we can ask the aggregated question. How does a society look which has a system of Buddhist temples, which has a system of a real penetrating religious ideology or a system of ideas which get down to the individual and family level? How does that society behave either similarly or differently from a society which is without religion or a society which is Christian or Muslim? In other words, that's a great micro-foundational question to ask. We can ask, how do those religious practices then influence individual decision-making and choice, which then leads to aggregate social patterns? I've got some examples here. I'm not going to talk about them because I'd like to finish before an hour. But a kind of summary on micro-foundations, there is no such thing as pure social-to-social causation. No such thing as... Yeah, let's get rid of this. What I'm saying is this does not occur. Instead, what occurs is from social to local agency to social. This is really the model that I would suggest having in mind. There is no such thing as causation directly from the social to the social. What there is social embodied in local circumstances working itself forward, leading to another social state of affairs. And this brings us to the concept of methodological localism. So what I'm really asserting is that the, and this is, I don't know what slide number this is, but it's kind of close to the end. It's called the framework of methodological localism. The idea here is that the socially situated individual in a local context is the molecule of social phenomena. That it's individuals within social context which are the real kind of causal and dynamic actor which brings about social circumstances and social outcomes. And what I want to say is that this is a better level of description than either a purely global description of social phenomena up here, or for that matter, a purely asocial description, a description of individuals without any social context. What I'm asserting is a kind of gluing together the individual as socially constructed and informed within a local set of arrangements which directly impinge upon him or her, and then the individual is a deliberative actor. But notice that the social stuff comes into that story in two different directions. The individual is shaped and formed through social contact and social development, through family circumstances, through religion, through schooling, through universities, through the public media. Those are all social influences constituting the individual. And then the individual within a current set of social arrangements behaves or doesn't behave, chooses or chooses not to engage in various kinds of behavior, and then we get a new pattern. Tax, the payment of taxes would be a great example. Every state wishes to collect taxes. So the Italian state, the French state, the Chinese state, all want to collect taxes. And in the central ministry, they make declarations like income tax is 30% of your income, or land tax is 10% of the total value. So policy declarations are made, but then following this point, we now have to say, what are the institutional realization? What is the institutional realization going from the policy at the center to the actual implementation at the village level or the individual level? This is where the new institutionalism comes in. The level of tax payment in Italy is, I think, the lowest in all of Europe. So Italians are the very best in all of Europe at evading income tax. Did you know that? They don't pay a lot of income tax in Italy. In the United States, the payment rate is pretty high. Now you might say, well, of course it's high. They have enforcers. You'll go to jail if you evade taxes. But the reality actually is that enforcement of taxation is very, very difficult because you can't have one tax enforcer for every agent. And so tax evasion, lying on taxes, I think the rate of audits in the United States is maybe, I don't know, 1%. So an audit is when the tax authorities come and look at your records and see whether you have correctly reported your income. But the amount of enforcement is tiny. And so what explains the fact that in some democracies, taxation is pretty well collected, and in other democracies, it's pretty poorly collected? Well, there we need methodological localism. We need to know what are the institutions, what are the ways in which tax policies are implemented, and what are the incentives and opportunities which exist either for payment of your taxes or evasion of your taxes. And so the idea of methodological localism is, in a sense, it is a theory that is directly related to the theory of methodological individualism, but it's also a theory which is directly related to this idea that deliberative agency of socially constructed individuals, that is the unit of social activity. I want to assert that it is, now it may sound to you, I'm contradicting myself, but I want to assert to you it is not an individualist view. It's not an individualist view because the agents that I'm referring to are agents who find themselves already and always in social circumstances. They are not, you know, kind of psychological atoms separated from society. Instead, at any given time, they've been formed by their past history. They are in the context of relationships, institutions, and networks, and they perform actions which influence other people. So that what I say is methodological localism is not a purely individualist theory, it is rather a local social individualist theory. It is the individual within local social circumstances and having been socially constructed through the history of the individual's development. I want to refer to social construction here, which is probably a social construction of the individual. This idea of social construction is an idea which has been used very much by the postmodernist types. My use is much more ordinary and humdrum, much more ordinary and easily understood. It is the fact that at any given time, an individual has taken shape through many, many social influences. That the values that I have, the beliefs I have about the world, possibly the spiritual ideas that I have, the ideas I have about what works and what doesn't work. I, for example, am ignorant relative to you about how to use this thing. So, well, actually, you're all ignorant about how to use this thing. None of us was able to make it work. But there are many ordinary facts about Chinese society that you know that I don't know. Those are facts that you have learned through your immersion in Chinese society, which are very strange to me. You know, strange, I don't mean weird. I mean, they're unknown to me. Well, that is an example of how you have been socially constructed and I have been socially constructed in a different way. There will be processes in the United States that you will find strange also. One totally kind of unimportant example is the fact that if you're waiting for a bus in the United States, or if you're waiting for a bus in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain, people queue very, very carefully. So people are very aware the first person who arrived gets the first entrance into the bus, the second person arrives. In other societies, people just mill. So as soon as the subway arrives, they just all kind of try to push in. Well, that would be a social difference. If you were to do that in England, you would be thought to be, you know, a boor. You would be thought to be very impolite. But if you were to do it in Hong Kong or in Tokyo, that's just how you board a subway. There's nothing wrong with it at all. That's just how you behave. Well, that would be an example of social construction. It is acquiring a knowledge of the ways that people should act in various circumstances. This idea of methodological localism refers easily to norms, to institutions, to belief frameworks, and to other social entities which are above the level of the individual. So just to take one example, belief framework. And then we've got the individual here. The belief framework is what, you know, what I would say is it's a set of ideas about how things work in a given society. In one sense, it is socially embodied, so everyone in Beijing knows where to go to buy cheap DVDs. Everybody knows that. Tourists don't know that until they're quickly informed by the ladies on the street who say cheap DVDs. You can quickly learn how to find cheap DVDs, I guess. But the point is, the belief framework is in one sense socially embodied, independent of individuals. If you were to suddenly forget everything you knew about Beijing, nonetheless, the belief framework is still there. Other people would still learn their beliefs. You would be the one person who knew nothing about it, but the belief framework would still be there. However, what methodological localism says is we have to be able now to talk about the pathways by which the individual gets introduced into the belief framework. And what are those pathways? They're totally simple. You grow up in your family, your dad takes you on an outing, he says, that's the place to get the cheap DVDs. Don't go on that bus, it goes to the bad part of town. Be careful on the street because there are holes in the sidewalk. In other words, you learn from your father or your mother lots of background practical knowledge. You go to school and you learn how to interact with... In other words, what I'm telling is a very simple kind of social story about how individuals come to get incorporated into the belief framework. And finally, the belief framework has no reality beyond the current states of beliefs of Beijingers. If the current Beijingers were to forget everything, that belief framework would disappear. So the belief framework is embodied in individuals. It is partially independent of particular individuals, so one person can forget without harming the belief framework. And we can tell a development story, a childhood development story, that accounts for how the individual is brought into the belief framework. And that is a microfoundational story, it is a methodological localist story, and it's a story about how we manage to accomplish social explanation. So I've now got dramatic questions. If you take this perspective seriously, take the deliberative social actor, the rational choice perspective, take the microfoundations perspective, and take the methodological localism perspective, I put it to you that we can now reconceptualize what is the nature of social science research. That's a very powerful statement for you to make, and I'm probably overstating myself a little, but what I am asserting is we could say all social science research amounts to research on one of five types of questions. First of all, what makes individuals tick? What makes them act as they do? And so this would be an account of the processes of choice, the processes of cognition, the ways in which people act and choose to act. That's one big question. It's what you might call social psychology. A second big question is the developmental question. How do individuals come to have these propensities of behavior and choice? What is the training? What is the education? What is the family context? That's a second big question. How do individuals get socially constituted? So how do they get their preferences, their worldview, their moral frameworks? Third big question, how do institutions and norms influence individuals' behavior? What I say, the institution of fixed rent in peasant farming, is one where the peasant pays a fixed cash amount to the landlord. Well, the question is, how do those institutions actually enforce themselves? It's not enough for the county magistrate to say, here's how rent works, because individuals can always find ways of evading. And so we have to ask, how are the institutions actually embodied so that they continue to function? So that's the third big question. How do institutions and norms actually influence individuals' behavior? Fourth big question, how do individuals' choices then aggregate to the middle and higher level? And here we can make use of things like game theory, economic theory, political science, to do the aggregation or the modeling. Maybe that's a better explanation, actually, is the question, what does aggregative explanation mean? A different term is agent-based modeling. Are you familiar with that concept? Agent-based modeling. Of social process. So agent-based modeling. If we take a set of assumptions about the motives that people have and the institutional setting in which they operate, we can now use computer modeling techniques to kind of put together like a SimCity. SimCity, do you know that the game? It's a game where you get to develop a city and you put some buildings in place and you put a fire department in place. Maybe you haven't seen it. But it's a simple example of of agent-based modeling or simulation. And basically what you're doing is you're saying hypothesize motivations in institutional context, hypothesize tens of thousands of agents, and then see what their interactions lead to. And a good example would be traffic simulation. There are six ring roads around the city of Beijing, six ring roads. And it would be an interesting question. So you have et cetera, okay. Here's an interesting social question. What would happen if you created a diagonal superhighway crossing Beijing? What would happen to the pattern of traffic in all of the ring roads? That's a good question to ask because you'd want to know. You'd want to know, would the Olympics be easier to host in Beijing if traffic were improved? Would traffic be improved by a road across here? Well, one way of answering that question is agent-based simulation. Your computer would have, I don't know, 3 million, there are probably 3 million cars on the road at any given time in Beijing, so you might have 300,000 simulated agents. You would attribute to them destinations and cost constraints, and then you would give them the new set of avenues that are available, and you would just see within that simulation what is the pattern of traffic. That would be an example of an agent-based simulation. And it is also an example of the aggregation from individual level assumptions up to large-scale behavior.